Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is brought to you by Verizon Media, creating what's next in content, advertising, and technology. With brands like Yahoo, HuffPost, and TechCrunch, Verizon Media transforms how people stay informed and entertained, communicate, and transact.
Hey, everybody. This is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of Ad Exchanger. Good to be with you again. I'm pleased to have Doug Ray in the studio. Doug is the chairman of media for the Dentsu Aegis Network. He has a long career in media and media planning dating back to the early 90s. He rose through the ranks as a media planner, eventually becoming CEO, first in the U.S. and then globally for Kara, which is the same year, and this was 2013, the same year Dentsu acquired Kara's parent, Aegis. It's a little complicated, as often the case with media agency groups. But Dentsu Aegis has been, and specifically the media network, has been on a real hot streak, winning United, Louis Vuitton, Intel, and Procter & Gamble lately. It's now the fastest growing media network among the holding companies. And RECMA says it grew 28% in the year 2018, making it the largest U.S. media agency in that study. That was Kara, the largest U.S. media agency in that study. So a lot of energy and a lot of momentum here. I'm delighted to have Doug in the studio to talk about Dentsu Aegis in the industry at large. Welcome, Doug.
Welcome, Zach. How are you?
I'm great. Good to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
So there's been so much upheaval in media, and yet you are kind of a testament to the fact that individual careers don't need to end just because the world changes. I'm curious, though, from your point of view, through the kind of the dot-com era, then mobile, programmatic, people-based buying, what was going through your head, and did you always find this field still an interesting place to be?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting, I like to mentor a lot of young people, you know, who think that their career trajectory is going to come from moving to lots of different places. And if you look at my career, I've been at three companies in more than 25 years. And I think that the reason that I've been with only three companies over that time period is because of the opportunity that I've sought out within those organizations. Now, two of those organizations, first starting at Emirati and Puris, which is an independent agency acquired by IPG in 1994, and then Aegis Media that was acquired by Dentsu in 2013, as you said, acquisitions also provide lots of opportunity. But I think at the end of the day, the curiosity has got to be there, you know, and the desire to continually learn about the industry and have passion for where that industry is going. And I think importantly, be an advocate for your client, because clients cannot keep up with all the changes that are going on, and they are looking to their agencies and they're looking for those individuals that are leading their individual client accounts to be the single point of contact to help them navigate, you know, this changing landscape. So that actually puts a lot more pressure on our integrated business leaders today than there has ever been on those individuals before. So you have to continue to be a student in this industry in order to be able to help be a good client partner.
Okay, great. Well, you're hinting at some of the changes in the client mindset and what their needs. We're going to come back to that. But I'd like to spend a minute talking about Dentsu and Dentsu Aegis, just to make sure the audience has their head wrapped around what you guys are and what you do. Talk about first about like Dentsu Aegis. So this is, you know, the non-Japan division of a Japanese corporation.
Correct, yeah.
Right, okay.
So Dentsu obviously is the largest largest agency in Japan. They have, you know, the lion's share of business over there, and they obviously had aspirations to grow their business outside of Japan and started doing a number of acquisitions well before Aegis Media even came into the picture. Around 2012, which just coincided also with the time that Aegis Media won our largest piece of business, which was the consolidated global General Motors business, which happened to be the largest global contract in the history of advertising in terms of the consolidation of contracts into a single contract. I think that was sort of the tipping point for Aegis Media really being a viable acquisition for Dentsu. Obviously, our strength in Aegis Media was primarily in media, although we had some digital creative capabilities and some analytics capabilities within an agency like Isobar. But that acquisition that happened in 2013 fundamentally changed the composition of Dentsu and created the Dentsu Aegis Network, which is the operations outside of Japan. And the Dentsu Aegis Network has an operating board, has a CEO, and then has a leadership team. And it consists, you know, now of a lot of media agencies that came over from Aegis Media, although we've launched new agencies in the last few years, Dentsu X being one of those agencies. And we've made acquisitions that have further transformed the operations outside of Japan, namely the Merkle acquisition that was done in 2016. So the composition of the Dentsu Aegis Network today is fundamentally different than what it was when Dentsu began their acquisition strategy more than a decade ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Yeah, like so close to $10 billion worth of acquisitions.
Yes.
Leading to tens of billions of dollars in growth. Mm-hmm. And I think a major move from a country-specific agency into the West, and it seems we all take it for granted now, but it turned out it was quite a prescient move given the growth and the sort of expansion of digital ad spend across Europe and
absolutely. And I think the other thing that that we've been able to do is because we are the youngest of all the major global networks that are out there, we're also slightly smaller than a number of those networks, which gives us ability to be more future focused and agile in terms of the service model that we think clients are going to require in the future, which is why we're also going through a fundamental business restructure that was just announced a couple of weeks ago, that moves us into a more solutions-oriented focus for our clients as opposed to a service-oriented focus. Now, if I could just explain that
what
a little
bit.
Yeah. So if you think about, you know, media planning or media buying or creative campaign development or CRM development and management, those are all services. Those are all services that a client can buy from an agency. But we're finding more and more is the complexity of what clients are looking for, which has really been driven by the rise of data and the collapse of the marketing departments and the technology departments within clients. Those worlds are now coming together, and clients are recognizing the value of a direct-to-customer relationship and the importance of first-party data that they've been doing a very good job of utilizing for direct-to-marketing purposes, but generally that has not been connected to any of their media and certainly not to their broader advertising assets. And so what we're looking to do is actually move to a solutions orientation where we can build a relationship with a client and we can pull the services out of the different agencies to create a custom solution for that client, which is exactly what we've done with United, with Intel, with LVMH, with Subway, just to name a few of the accounts that we've won over the course of the last couple of years.
So for the clients for whom you're providing a solutions approach, like an integrated model, mm-hmm. Are they running their RFP process with that integration as a requirement, or is it something? Is it gravy? Is it something you're adding on top when you win the media business, for mm-hmm. example?
I think it's a little bit of both, but for sure, with some of these pitches, let's just take Intel and United. We had an existing creative relationship. McGarry Bone had been the creative AOR for both of those businesses on a global basis, and so while creative was not in under review for those assignments, there were other relationships. Merkle had relationships with some of those clients existing. We had other companies within the network that also had relationships. Extensively, that was a media pitch. However, it would be you know, it would not behoove us to ignore the other relationships that we have with those networks. And therefore, it's incumbent upon us to organize ourselves in order to demonstrate the value of how media is more integrated into these other aspects of mm-hmm. the work that they may already be doing with some of our companies.
Okay, great. So, but you still have a media vertical.
I own the media vertical.
And you run it.
That's correct.
What is it? What does it consist of? I mean, I think we all know what media planning and buying is, but...
Sure. Very simply, I have all of the full-service media agencies like Acara, Avisium, Dentsu X, as well as the performance agencies. I prospect being the largest performance agency. There are smaller agencies that we've acquired in there as well. I also have responsibility for our entire buying, which is about $13 billion under management, and also our data platform M1 and how that is underpinning and supporting all of our media from an end-to-end standpoint. And then the last thing is the Story Lab, which is our content division, which we are completely transforming to be reflective of the types of content programs that clients are seeking today.
Okay, got it. Terrific. So when you step back and look at the media space from an agency and marketer point of view, what are the biggest changes that are underway right now?
I would say, not to oversimplify this, Zach, but I think that there are two kind of buckets of what clients are seeking today, and that's because there are fundamental underpinnings of transformation that are happening in there. They're ultimately looking for growth, right? And we believe that growth is going to come in two ways. One is connecting brands better to culture and the passions that people have related to culture, right? People aren't necessarily looking for the ads within, you know, the Major League Baseball. They're passionate about their local team, right? So how do we connect brands into the passions that people have for their league, for their player, you know, and for the sport in general? So that's one area. The other is driving more relevance through personalization. And so, you know, both of them have content as a component of that. So content is becoming more important to the media conversations because at the end of the day, I think where we're coming back to is the importance of context. So media is not just about the channel in which a message will be placed. It also is importantly more and more about the context in which the consumer will experience that communication. And so the context of walking here this morning and, you know, reading an article or watching a YouTube video, that's a very different context mm-hmm. than sitting at home, kicking back, having a glass of wine, and, sure. and watching something on television.
So at first blush, that comment about context would seem to be a little bit of a dig at programmatic, which has become focused on audience to the exclusion of context. Mm. But can you incorporate context into programmatic and data-driven buying?
100%. Yeah. And I think that's what we have to get to is a new discipline within, I'd say, the media industry, and I would say more generally the marketing industry, which is we have to get to really a focus on audiences and an audience strategy. Several years ago, I used to talk about media agencies becoming audience agencies, and I was making a point, which is we need to think much more about where's the source of volume going to come from? Are we growing a category? Are we stealing share? Which audiences are going to be appealing to the brand that we have. And it may not be one mass audience. It's likely to be sub audiences within that. The way you define your audience now more and more is based on many different types of data sets that are out there. So to your point about context, we now have the ability to build audiences based on context. So we can look at bidstream data from a programmatic, and we can understand, is this an audience that's more likely to be landing on and spending time on baseball content? And therefore, we can build an audience of baseball intenders or baseball enthusiasts based on the contextual activity that they're demonstrating from a digital standpoint. Mm-hmm. We could also completely start in a different place, which is we could work with Live Nation, and they have a significant amount of purchase-based data and look for people who have purchased tickets to go to Major League Baseball games. Two different starting places to address the issue of targeting baseball fans, two different data sets. What's to say one is better than the other? It's really depending upon what we're trying to accomplish and where we're ultimately going to be activating that media.
Got it. And you also said clients want to grow. They need to grow. That's the point.
That's right.
That's the point of marketing.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet growth is hard to come by in some traditional categories. Mm-hmm, you know, CPG is the one everybody thinks of. It's just hard to grow there. There's a lot of new entrants in that world. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it looks like CPG may lose its status as kind of the hero of advertising, the largest spender, to be replaced somewhat ironically by tech. Do you see ongoing challenges to growth that are just sort of inbuilt for the CPGs in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think that there is, there are Ernber Bass, you know, and a lot of companies, a lot of CPG companies sort of look to his media principles for growth. Right. And there are books that have been written about the media principles to growth. And I think oftentimes what we have to look at is those aren't necessarily principles that are no longer valid. But, you know, reaching as many category buyers when they're in the purchase cycle is still a very valid principle. The issue is that if we look to linear television as a means to reach as many category buyers while they're in the purchase cycle, and that's the only way that we're looking at that, because that's how we've always done that. And historically, right, market mix modeling has demonstrated that television has yielded the greatest return on investment or the greatest sales contribution. We've got to challenge that thinking, right? We need to think differently about the legacy models. We 100% support the role that linear television plays, but we need to look at things like how is frequency distributed across different age cells, different audience segments, different quintiles of viewership? And we need to be able to have more sophisticated means of being able to look at those audiences and, importantly, plan cross-screen as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a very simple thing and something that we've been talking about for well over 3 to 4 years now. And we've developed some proprietary tools that help us to do that. So very often we'll look at what a client has been doing before they have come into our orbit, you know, maybe as part of a pitch. And we often can diagnose that there's some real opportunities that the client has left on the table that simply will improve the productivity and the effectiveness of those dollars being spent. Mm. Or in some cases, they can achieve the same metrics that they've achieved in the past, but do that for significantly less dollars.
What about the big brands and their willingness to spend on marketing? Because there's been a lot of coverage of sort of pressure on the marketing budgets of some of the world's largest advertisers, coming from corporate raiders and activist investors and private equity, frankly. I think there was a thesis held by people like 3G Capital that these brands were self-sustaining. The Kraft, Heinz, Oscar Mayer, they could never fail to connect with people because they
saw what happened with Kraft Heinz.
Part of the national, they're part of the national consciousness or global, whatever. Yeah. People were always going to buy Heinz ketchup. Not so.
No.
So do you think, it turns out there was, just to finish the thought, there was a $15 billion write-down at Kraft Heinz. Their market share was kind of eaten away by other new competitors and existing competitors. So, does this lead to a reversal of the trend of budget cuts? Do you think that private equity is going to have to acknowledge, well, we can't cut marketing spend without losing share?
So I don't know if it will reverse an entire trend, right?
Yeah.
But absolutely, you cannot expect growth without investment. I've been in this business for 25 years. Every single time I've seen a brand, whether it's a direct-to-client, direct-to-consumer, or direct response, or it's a branding client, I've seen response to sales through investment in marketing and advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the idea that we're going to cut all marketing and expect the brand to grow, you know, if you've looked at any market mix modeling reports, you know, again, advertising and marketing generally, and I'm going to talk about this through the lens of CPG now, because it varies. Retail is a significant different number here. But in CPG, between 7 and 12% of incremental sales come from marketing and advertising, right? The remainder is made up of distribution, sales promotion, and a very, very large component is made up of what's called the base, which is the equity.
Mm-hmm.
that erodes over time when you're not priming the pump, when you're not feeding that equity and that base. So you can get away with not advertising for a period of time, but at some point that will have a direct impact on your ability to maintain your sales. Mm-hmm. And as that base begins to erode, it accelerates. So if you're not feeding that equity, if you're not feeding the base with advertising and marketing, again, you may not see a direct impact in a short period of time, but that will accelerate over time.
Got it. Okay, we're going to take a moment's break here from a sponsor. I'll be right back with Doug Ray. Hi, it's Zach Rogers, and I'm back with Jeff Lucas, head of North American Sales and Global Client Solutions with our sponsor, Verizon Media. Jeff, what is Verizon Media's approach to transparency and control?
Verizon Media, we offer scaled, premium, professionally produced, brand-safe content. We're ranked number one by our users in a premium, non-UGC environment. We offer comprehensive ad fraud and brand safety solutions, offering a brand from a brand safety coalition of third-party players, leaders in the industry. Basically, we have Moat, DoubleVerify, IAS. Clients can choose the solution that best works for them. But we think it's very important.
Great. And so Verizon Media controls a pretty large supply chain. What does it include today?
Our supply chain includes the premium brand safe content. Advertisers have access to our exclusive inventory and unique supply of this, you know, professionally produced across Yahoo News, sports, entertainment, finance, homepage, and email. And also those great brands of HuffPo, TechCrunch, Engadget, and Autoblog. 74% of our users come directly from one Verizon Media property to another. So once they're in, they find more and more content that they're very interested in.
And we hear a lot about 5G and its impacts, future impacts on advertising. From your point of view, as a Verizon subsidiary, how will 5G affect the advertising space?
I think with 5G, the possibilities are endless. 5G is a quantum leap in wireless technology that will bring an era of radically new possibilities across all areas of tech. It's not just about a network. It's a new platform on which future innovation will be built. In addition to significant speed upgrades, which you hear about all the time, 5G will also bring 10x battery life, which is, you know, can always use, and also 1,000x larger data volume, more than anything that has come before. And Verizon is leading in real 5G. They were the first in the home, delivering real tangible value to advertisers. Backed by Verizon, Verizon Media is ideally positioned to help marketers understand and optimize their advertising in a 5G world. Last fall, we launched a state-of-the-art Riot Innovation Studio. Riot's our creative arm of Verizon Media, which will house a 5G lab and be located at Verizon Media's Playa Vista campus. It'll show clients how 5G impacts speed, video, interactive formats, and also how it applies to data and targeting. So advertisers and consumers are both excited about the launch of 5G. We can't wait.
Wonderful. Well, Jeff, thanks again. Thanks for your support.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hi, and I'm back with Doug Ray from Dentsu Aegis. We've been talking about client mindsets, and I want to touch on another aspect of the client mindset, which is sort of how they think about advice. And the agency used to be the primary source of advice on the consumer. Help me understand my customer, because I don't get it. I just make cereal. And so you guys have been a great partner to the agencies for many decades. You guys, I'm generically referring to you as the agencies. Mm-hmm. And now there are more sources of knowledge. So you have the consultants coming in, and you have tech coming in and being a partner to the brand. And you have brands looking to themselves and internal resources for knowledge capabilities. So it's not... I guess, you know, there are different ways to kind of think about that. You know, you could say, well, the role of the advisor is just a broader role now, and that's mm-hmm. as it should be in a complicated tech-driven period in history. But when it comes to the relationship between this set of companies known as the agencies with their clients, how do you then continue to demonstrate value? How do you create a meaningful relationship where they want you and need you around?
Yeah, that's a great, great question in the sense that I think this industry has been dealing with something for the last couple of years that where there's been a fundamental erosion in trust between the clients and the agencies. And that has led clients to do a number of things, to take marketing services in-house, to look to other suppliers for advice, to challenge certain contracts or certain ways of operating or certain supply chains that have existed. I think it's all for the better because I do think that there needed to be a big wake-up call for this industry. I think the future is ultimately going to be built on the trust that a marketer has with their advisor. And at the end of the day, they are seeking two things, I think. They're seeking advice and counsel, and they're seeking then operational execution as well. And what we have to recognize, and we have recognized that at the Dentsu Aegis Network, is that we don't have to do everything on behalf of a client. You know, when I started in this business, in the 90s, we did do everything and it was all integrated into one agency and those relationships were highly, highly trusted relationships. I think today where we're at is there are more options that clients have. There's more complexity. And in many cases, I think clients take things in-house in some respects to learn and to understand, even if that's not a long-term solution for them. Because I think that things are moving so quickly that many clients can't keep up and don't understand. And if their business isn't growing, their superiors, their bosses are going to come to them and expect them to know how to fix the problem. And if they completely outsource that to whomever, supplier, agency that they choose to work with, and they don't fundamentally understand, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. So I think that what you're going to see with agencies is re-articulating their value proposition in the sense that we can actually execute for you if you choose us to do that, and we will advise and consult. Mm-hmm. So let's take programmatic as an example where there's been lots of discussion and there's been lots of activity over the course of the last several years where clients have taken programmatic in-house. What we have tended to find is that they might make that decision, but they're not entirely sure what that means. So they need someone to help them with their tech stack. They need someone to help them with their developing their ID, their identity graph.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've seen agencies spring up with that value
absolutely.
Proposition. Our job is to help you take it in-house.
Yeah, yeah. And Merkle's done a great job of that, over the years. And, and we're leaning into that to be able to say, we don't have to do that. We've built an incredible data product that came with the acquisition of Merkle called M1. And we offer that to clients in sort of a managed service capacity where we are working with them, working with their first-party data, or if they don't have first-party data, we have access to over 40 different data partners, and we control about 242 million universal IDs in our own Dentsu Aegis Network CRM database, effectively. So we can do that as part of our media planning and buying assignment for a client. Some clients are building those capabilities in-house, and they don't want to put all of their identity eggs, if you will, into an agency's basket. So what we're doing is we're actually moving towards a model where we're licensing the underlying identity graph that we've built to a client, even if we're not their media planning or buying agency. So,
okay.
So this has happened on a number of occasions.
Software model.
Essentially, yes.
Okay.
And,
great.
And it's then complements and supplements what those clients are doing.
You mentioned Merkle, and your acquisition of Merkle was the first in what turned out to be maybe a series of data acquisitions by holding companies. And the second was IPG acquiring Acxiom. And the third, which may come to be, is Publicis, which has put out a statement recently saying they're evaluating acquiring Epsilon. Now, I should say we're, you know, this is at the time of this recording. It's possible when listeners hear this that there will have been a development in that story. So please forgive us if we seem a little behind the headlines here. But when you think about agencies bringing data assets in-house, like, what's the value to agencies there? Are they great businesses, for example, or do they help you do your job any better?
They definitely help us do our job better because, as I said before, you know, the path to growth is about helping brands become part of culture and also be much more relevant through personalized communications. You can't create personalization at scale if you don't have two things, an identity solution that you can either plug into a client's own identity solution, or that identity solution becomes the solution for the client. Mm-hmm. That identity solution then connected to an inventory solution. So the future is absolutely about doing this. And I think where the networks are going, where the agencies are going, is recognizing that that is what clients are seeking. There is no better source of the truth. There's no better asset out there than a client's first party data. Mm-hmm. That will always be the place that we want to start.
But they want to mingle that with other identity assets that can help them find their clients.
That's exactly
right. They're on the web and in the real world.
We built M1 and Data Source, which is the underlying data product, because Merkle was, and I should say Merkle built this, because they were building and they were the AOR for many companies' CRM databases. And what they found is that the clients would come to them and say, fantastic, we now know everything we need to know about our customers, but we want to either know more about those customers that might look like those customers, or we want to understand more about beyond just their relationship with our brand, we want to understand their relationship with the world. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, these data acquisitions have to also be attached to a human insights or human intelligence team as well, that's about mining that data to derive human insights, mm-hmm. human truths, that those insights are springboards for creativity, springboards for media planning and buying, springboards for other types of marketing assets that can be developed using those insights.
Mm-hmm. Great. So you made a reference earlier to like trust and how this challenge had to happen mm-hmm. around the client agency relationship. And you know, I have a sort of a point of view on this that I agree with you. I also think that one of the trade associations in this industry made a concerted effort to sort of explode the trust relationship between agencies and mm-hmm. clients. Mm-hmm. And maybe they were trying to help along what they thought was a flawed situation and help bring it to an end. But they focused on that. And then they continued to focus on it. And it's to the exclusion of some other issues in this industry that are also large and important to talk mm-hmm. about. And I'm specifically thinking of the growing clout of Google, Facebook and Amazon and other platforms, mm-hmm. their mm-hmm. control of the customer relationship, their control of a vast amount of data, and their control of media. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It amounts to a huge footprint that allows them to dictate the terms of media to everyone, including the agencies mm-hmm. and including the clients. The trade associations are afraid of Google, Facebook in particular because they sponsor their events and because they sit on their boards and committees, and nobody wants to piss off Google because, hey, you might get hired there. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of brands end up going to work at Google.
Right, right.
That's a viable career path if you're a marketer.
I can think of more than two hands full of people that have
gone over. Yeah. So if you're working at you live in Cincinnati or Battle Creek and you're into digital marketing and get up on stage at an A&A event, well, are you going to say something bad about Google? Google's right back there. Anyway, I'm going on a bit about this, but I wonder what you think about the platforms and their influence and what seems to me like a bit of surprising silence on some of the problems associated with these companies coming from the I know advertisers love to talk about the brand safety issue. That's real.
Yes.
Yep. And there are issues that they are holding Google and Facebook's feet to the fire on. Mm-hmm. Viewability is another one. And verification. There, it's not like there is no discussion. But I do think that there's a real sort of need for a larger discussion around things like attribution and data ownership.
Yep.
And, you know, what are your thoughts?
So you know, you said brand safety, obviously data privacy. These are probably the two biggest issues that, you know, two out of those three major global media companies, and, I think they don't like to refer to themselves as media companies. I think they would like to refer to them as tech companies. Mm-hmm. And in some respects, they do, you know, that with the exception of Facebook, you know, they have cloud-based services. Those cloud services are used by a number of marketers, agencies, you know, to run the technology, the underpinnings of the technology for their business. But they also are publishers, you know, and more they're creating content as well, and they're distributing that content. And so there is absolutely a expectation, and there is a requirement from that for them to act the same with the same level of quality standards that the broadcast publishers and the print publishers, you know, have been responsible for years and years. So let's set that aside, because the marketers have been very vocal about privacy issues, and Google or Facebook taking down customer marketplaces and shutting that down is a reaction to certainly some of the privacy issues. Mm-hmm. YouTube leaning much more into original content, partnering with companies to create higher quality content. But setting that aside, the biggest issue that I see is that these companies are just getting bigger, mm-hmm. and they're getting more valuable for marketers, particularly marketers that are looking to close the loop between advertising and purchase and understand the attribution between those. You can look at an entire ecosystem, if you will, and I hate using that word because it's sort of a buzzword, right? We could ban that word from our lexicon, it'd be great. But if you look at the consumer journey that somebody takes within the Google infrastructure, or the same thing within the Amazon infrastructure, we know and can see, or they can see, somebody searches on something, someone watches a video, someone goes and purchases something, that they receive a receipt for that purchase in their Google Mail. They can close that loop, right? And that's a very powerful proposition for a client. The reality is that 100% of consumers' journeys, experiences do not live within the walls of Facebook, Google, and Amazon. And while those are important for us to have relationships with, we have to be much broader and much more holistic in our view. So there's this love-hate relationship between them, where we have to do business with them, but we have to hold them accountable, and we can't get...
Is it possible to hold them accountable?
I think the industry has to hold them accountable. And this is where, you know, the 4A's and the ANA and some of the other large bodies have to come together as opposed to be separate. And I think that for too long, over the last few years, we've been separate as opposed to aligned on, you know, what we're trying to solve in the industry.
Yeah, right. Makes sense. Yeah. Okay, thanks for fielding that one. We're nearing the end of our time, but I want to get in a question on television. Obviously, this is a changing area, and the change is going to accelerate. Mm-hmm. Addressable television media is now starting to scale. We reported recently on what looks a little bit like a turf war between traditional television buyers at the agencies and new and digital buyers who want to sort of, start to be active mm-hmm. in television media. As it starts to behave more like digital media.
Right.
What are your observations on how this plays out within the agencies and more largely, like, what's the opportunity in TV?
Yeah. I can't speak for the other agencies, but what we've done is, you know, and this is done more than 5 years ago, we moved from having TV buyers to video buyers. Now, that's not to say that there are people that are more focused on, let's say, response-oriented metrics that are maybe more in a digital team mm-hmm. that are also buying video through the same suppliers that our video team, or what was our TV team, is doing as well. So let me just separate that. So let me go to where the majority of the money is spent, which is historically those TV buying groups within the agency holding company. So again, we've moved to a video buying group. They are responsible for the strategy for that money. And generally, it comes down to, what are we trying to achieve with that? So what is the role? What has been the role of TV? Is it about awareness, top of mind awareness, consideration? What are we trying to accomplish with that? And therefore, how do we think about the different levers that we can pull? So we kind of look at this as a multi-step evolution for clients that we onboard into the agency, where we might start with, they've traditionally been using traditional linear television, and we need to get them to start to think about, you know, streaming or OTT as another day part. And we can prove to them by just moving some money over into those additional channels, even if they don't change the demographic audience, they don't move to an addressable audience, they still talk about demos, that we can achieve more reach, more balanced frequency for the same or less dollars by doing that, right? With the same quality standards and the same measurement capabilities. The other move that we're looking to make is attacking things like cable, right? Where the average rating is below a 0.1, I'm sorry. And what is the value of a buyer going and doing a physical deal with hundreds of different cable networks? So I would like to see 100% of our cable negotiations move into programmatic linear television or move into some other audience-based platform of buying. Mm. And we have done this for a number of clients where we've said, let's take 10% of your cable inventory and we're going to move it over into a programmatic approach, only 10%, and prove the value of that. Every time we've done that, we've moved to 20%, 30%, and so on. Mm-hmm. So there is a natural... progression or phasing that we're going to see, but it's about getting clients comfortable with that. And there are some fundamental, I would say, infrastructural piping issues that still, measurement issues that still exist. And we'll try to resolve those over time, but we have to move now, you know, while we're also trying to solve some of these measurement and data issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. One last quick question for you on automation, because what you're speaking at hints at the automation potential of programmatic.
Yes.
And I think people have been wondering for years, like, does there come a point where programmatic and automation leads to just a reduction in headcounts at the holding companies? These are companies that employ tens of thousands of people, so... Yeah. Do we get there? Like, how does that...
The simple answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Automation and technology will have an impact on the number of individuals that we have in the organization. And here is where the fundamental rub is right now. Many, many clients remunerate their agencies on an FTE model.
Right.
There's no incentive for the agency to invest in technology to actually make the process more efficient. Mm-hmm. So we're doing it, and we're doing it first where we might have a commission model or where we might have a pay-for-performance model, and it's not tied to FTEs, or maybe where those FTEs are more overhead-oriented FTEs, mm-hmm. but we're absolutely doing that. I just saw a presentation where we're looking at a process that we do, a very simple process like budget reconciliation for digital invoices, and it was taking about 2,600 man-hours. And by employing a bot to do this, we've reduced it to 120 man-hours to do it. Mm-hmm. That gives back, you know, weekends to people. That gives back evenings to individuals. So from a work-life balance standpoint, even without impacting the number of FTEs, it dramatically gives back to people, which is creating issues and why people are leaving the sector anyway.
Less burnout,
yeah. Right? Over time, it may actually impact the FTEs, but we should be incentivized to look for those efficiencies, to be more streamlined, and to be able to do things with more speed and more accuracy.
Got it. All right. Great. Well, wonderful discussion. Doug, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Zach. Pleasure.
Thank you, listener, for tuning in to yet another episode of this podcast. We'll see you next week.
Tune in next week to hear more from Verizon Media. We help advertisers and publishers connect with their audiences through comprehensive solutions, not compromises. For more information, please visit verizonmedia.com. produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.